Hi, welcome to Real Talk. This is the show about anything, anything that piques my curiosity and hopefully yours. And if you've got questions you'd like an expert to address, you can send those questions to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. I'm here every Wednesday at 11 o'clock with experts on all kinds of subjects. And today we are talking with Woody Pollack, who is a mental health counselor and the community training coordinator for Vashon Alliance to Reduce Substance Abuse, particularly among youth. Welcome, Woody.
Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And this is kind of an interesting topic that I think a lot of our parents of teens can relate to, and it is, how do you deal with teenagers in a digital age? How do we keep them safe? How do we take advantage of the benefits of the internet? And how do we protect them from the dangers? And I'm going to start with the dangers.
Sure. Well, I think with anything that involves the level of access to information, both the positives that we want our young people to engage with when it comes to information. So, I mean, just when I think about just the last couple of years, the way that information has become so much more available, it's in my hip pocket. I'm carrying around a smartphone, yeah, and basically anything that I want to find out, I can find out at my fingertips. And the same is true for kids. It just so happens that teens and adolescents have a different level of interest on different subjects, some of which really concern us as adults. So having, I think it's a real positive having that degree of access to information, but without some really clear boundaries and expectations for kids, it does. It becomes a risk factor.
How does a parent set boundaries when, frankly, the kids have more technical knowledge and more apps, if you will, than we can even dream of? How does a parent find out about those things and begin to put boundaries around them?
Sure, sure. Well, it's tough. Teens and adolescents are in a stage of life where they're trying to get more independence, trying to develop more privacy that oftentimes with parents looks like secrecy. And as a mental health therapist, one of the things that I'm, and a parenting educator, one of the things that I'm constantly, one of my constant themes with parents is show up curious, and be able to create a space where you can just have a conversation with your teen about what's going on, or your child about what's going on. And that includes their digital media use. So I noticed in my own house, I have two stepchildren who are both teenagers. And the more that I can join them inside of their world while they're engaged in digital use, the more I can ask questions about what's going on that doesn't feel like judgment coming from me. Mm-hmm. They're not afraid of, oh my gosh, if I show them this thing, there's going to be some consequence, blah, 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 blah. So for me, it's a big, it's a big part of it is really about showing up with curiosity, because they are much more proficient in most of the things that they're using, Instagram, Snapchat, no kids use Facebook anymore, but those are the two big ones
Facebook
right now.
Facebook is for old people.
Yeah, exactly. I use Facebook, so of course my kids aren't going to be on there.
That's right.
But showing up with some humility and some curiosity about, show me what's going on, because I want to know, not just as your parent so I can consequence or create boundaries, but because I'm curious, I'm a curious human being, and I want to join you with where you're at. That has a tendency to open a doorway to just a greater conversation. And then as a parent, I can share my concerns without having it necessarily be a lecture about the way things should or shouldn't be.
Yeah, and that's a tough one, because showing up curious when you're terrified is kind of difficult. How does a parent turn their fear into curiosity? What do you have to do?
Wow. There's a whole nother radio show right there. How to turn fear into curiosity. Well, I think as I'm growing into my own sort of parenting and coming to understand the struggles of other parents that are dealing with children that are vastly different than mine, in both their interests and their behaviors and so forth. One of the things that I try and remember is being in a place where my parents were scared to death about the stuff that I was doing as an eighth mm-hmm. grader. Now, granted, that my digital involvement was much less at that point. They were concerned about me watching too much TV.
Right.
Or, you know, at that point we were still video gaming, but it wasn't anywhere near the environment that kids are in now. But I survived. My parents were scared to death. And I survived. So one of the things that I'm regularly telling parents is we all made it through adolescence. We all made it there. And being able to show up with some of that emotional vulnerability with kids and say, wow, I'm really scared because I don't know what's going on in your life. Help me understand is different. There's a different posture there with kids that I want to support as much as possible with parents. It's a matter of creating connection as opposed to overlaying some sense of you must because I'm mom or I'm dad. Moms and dads are almost always, and I'm speaking in generalizations here, obviously, right. But mom and dads almost always have the rank within the relationship with their children. Kids know their mom and who their mom and dad are. They understand that there's rank and role involved in that. So for me as a parent, being able to sort of not pull rank with my kids and show up as an interested party rather than I'm your stepdad, you must do what I tell you to do, blah, 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 blah. Take down the garbage now. The more I can show up, even though I have that fear, more I can sort of check my process and be like, you know what? What I really want to do in this situation is create a connection with my child. It's okay for me to be fearful, maybe revealing a little bit of that to them. But the more I can create a connection even through that fear, wow, the more available are my child is going to be to me.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that really scare parents in a digital world. Mm-hmm. And I think the first that comes to my mind is sexting. It's probably a digital variation on an old theme. How can parents protect their kids? And I think another question would be, what do you see as the impact on kids who are involved in sexting in terms of their attitudes toward sexuality, toward members of the opposite sex?
Sure. So before I sort of jump in that bucket, I want to be clear that there are folks that their entire practice is really around teens and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And actually Varsa has brought some folks on to our island, Joe Langford being one. Mm-hmm. With his, he has a couple of books out recently. I'm trying to come up with the names of them right off the top of my head, but Varsa had Joe come in as a speaker, and I believe he spoke at the McMurray Middle School as well, specifically on this topic and sort of the dangers of a digital sexual presence, whether that be through sexting or pornography or things of that ilk. So you had asked me specifically about some of the dangers with sexting and so on and so forth, and how yeah. that sort of frames sexuality for kids. And I think when we're talking about adolescents and teens, just by nature of their process of maturation, there is a level of curiosity around sex and sexual topics and their own sort of process as they're understanding relationships and how sex fits in with that, which hasn't changed. That's been universal since there's been humans on the planet, that this time has been a time of curiosity and exploration. And going back to, you know, the couple minutes ago where we were talking about information, all that information, both good and bad, is available on the internet. And so kids as a part of their sort of normal process of maturation are seeking information. And doing it in ways that may not necessarily be appropriate or support their healthy growth when it comes to understanding sexuality and what it means for relationships. Certainly, sexting is one of those things, and Joe spoke to this pretty eloquently when he was here on the island. The distribution of images of children in a sexualized environment or naked pictures is the distribution of child pornography. So a lot of times, young men and young women don't understand that. And although there's not a whole lot of prosecution when they're, at least my understanding is at this point, there's not a lot of prosecution in our state of children, young people and teens who are distributing sexualized material over text. It's absolutely classified as a crime. So
it is.
Yes.
So it's peer-to-peer sexting, but it is a crime.
Yes. Yes.
That's interesting.
That's my understanding. Now, having something be listed as a crime and have it be necessarily enforceable is pretty difficult.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons that it was codified as a crime is because of the detrimental nature of young men and women being exposed to images as well as participating in distributing those images, taking pictures of themselves, requesting that a young male or female that they're interested in send them some sexualized images of themselves or nudes of themselves. There's a level of sort of developmental appropriateness that gets out of whack really quick when it comes to distributing sexual images. And I think, you know, we were talking about the access to information. There's a potential that is realized, I think, more with some youth than others, that the degree to which sexualized material is available on the internet really shapes their view of how readily accessible in the live world that material is, and creates some expectations around how people are with sex in the real world. And I mean, you and I both know that as adults, when we happen across or see that, we're like, oh, somebody is selling me something. And in this case, it happens to be sex.
Uh-huh.
It is my opinion that a lot of those sites that kids happen across, the reason that they happen across them and the way that the material is presented is really there to entice kids. It's a sales job.
Well, and the prevalence of pornography that is accessible to kids has been researched, and there have been some reports that indicate that the habitual use of pornography really impacts particularly young males, mm-hmm. In their sexuality to the point of impotence. And what can a parent do to protect kids from that sort of prevalence of pornography that may not have been accessible in the past?
Right. Well, I think there's two things. On the front end, it is having those difficult conversations about sex and sexuality and access to images as early as possible. I mean, let's face it, our children who are even before the age of adolescence are being exposed to this imagery, and it's creating confusion for them. So being able to lean forward into these conversations, even the ones that are uncomfortable, and especially those, as a parent, helps to shape and provide some boundaries for kids and creates an opening for them to come to us when they have questions. And so that would be the first piece, is just really start those conversations early, such that when there are big questions or there's concerns that come up, parents have a doorway into a conversation with their kid. It's not starting from zero, so to speak. And one of the things that I hear a lot, so I do parent education courses, and we talk, VARSA is focused on drug and alcohol reduction with youth and adults, but almost always inside of the classes that I teach with parents, the question comes up, well, what do I do? What do I do to monitor my child's use? And how do I put a lock on all these websites that could be, you know, all this stuff that comes into my house? I'm so concerned about it. How do I, you know, what's the filter?
Is that possible?
Well, it's certainly possible in the sense that there are companies that will sell sort of net nanny style software protection. But the reality is a curious child on the internet's going to find their way around that. Huh. So having some monitoring protocols in the house, some boundaries around digital use that support the parent being able to interact with their child around what they're watching. It's really difficult to do that if you have an iPad or a laptop or a smartphone. If the child has one in their bedroom, it's really difficult to monitor that without invading their privacy, so to speak. And one of the things that I say is, or that I encourage parents to do early on is, hey, keep the vast majority of digital use in public spaces in the house. And there's always pushback. There's pushback from kids and from parents. Well, what if they need to work on their homework and blah, 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 blah. You know, there's all these reasons why not to do that. It's less convenient and so on and so forth for kids and for parents. But to be able to start that conversation early and set up the boundaries early and then be able to expand as kids show responsible and reasonable use is really appropriate. Starting out with digital stuff in the bedroom, I think doesn't work. And I'm saying, I have seen some studies that say, well, we'll keep it all in public spaces so that, you know, people can monitor. And I've seen some that says, well, a certain amount of digital use, within a private environment for teens is acceptable. Look, the reality is, when parents show up curious and they can have conversations with their kids, they can set reasonable boundaries that support a child's growth. And that happens to carry over into digital use as well.
We're talking with mental health counselor Woody Pollack, who is also a community training coordinator for VARSA, Vashon Alliance to Reduce Substance Abuse, here on Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and we are able to do this thanks to the Hardware Store restaurant, serving great good food, free Wi-Fi, and signature cocktails in an historic 125-year-old building in the heartbeat of Vashon Island. It's 11:18 on the Voice of Vashon. And we're talking with Woody about parenting teens in the digital age. We've been talking about the dangers, the things that parents are afraid of, sexting, pornography. What about the vulnerability of kids to predators online? Is that still a problem, or have we gotten smarter about that?
Well, I think we're getting smarter, but as with anything that involves digital technology, things are constantly changing. And our youth have a tendency, most of our youth are pretty quick adapters of technology. Like, they get it.
Yeah.
My kids get it faster than I do. By leaps and bounds. So I think as a parent, when I am, and my kids are just about 16 and 17. Holy Chrome. That's coming
fast,
up quick. That's
it?
Right. Yeah. They'll both be 17 and soon to be 16. I worry less about it for them. I work in the middle school. And I see lots of opportunities for kids to get into situations with, we were just talking about sexting, but just digital use and relationships and so on and so forth that are online that they don't have a full understanding of what is involved in that. And I think that's, anytime kids have the opportunity to connect with faceless folks out in the world, there's an opportunity for exploitation of those relationships. I was just having a conversation with someone today. It's sort of on the same theme here, but we were talking about Instagram, and because the vast majority of kids are using Instagram and Snapchat for the reasons that they do. And there is a trend where kids will like something or they'll follow somebody's page because something came across their feed that was funny. There was a funny meme or a joke that went out and they thought it was hilarious. And so they, you know, they click follow or they click like or whatever. And oftentimes what kids don't understand is by following that person's Instagram feed or you know, for me, it's like them on Facebook. What I'm doing is I'm providing a digital signature that says, hey, I like this thing that comes out now. And there's a tacit, there's a tacit approval of the other material that is associated with that feed. And so I find myself when I'm on Facebook and I like something, something comes across my page and I may not entirely know the source of that, but I like the image that's up there, so I like it. And without going through and sort of drilling down through who sent this, all of a sudden on my feed, now I have somebody else's information that may have some really hateful or hurtful or sexually oriented stuff that I didn't know when I liked it. What I find when I talk with kids is that they don't have any concept of that. They don't understand this sort of tacit approval of the type of material that other people are putting out on the out in the World Wide Web or through their Instagram pages.
Or the digital invitation that they create
yes.
to others out there who are going to start feeding them or connecting them to information or websites that can be harmful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This goes back to that piece of parental monitoring and really showing up with curiosity. When kids are in elementary school or certainly in the first part of middle school, what I tell parents is if your kid has a social media page, make sure you're on it. A lot of times I get pushback from parents. Well, they could make up another page or so on and so forth. And I'm like, yep, all those things can happen. Kids are really smart about finding holes in fences. That's part of their job description as as adolescents and teens is to test our boundaries. Mm-hmm. So being able to show up curious and caring and have those conversations with their kids about, hey, show me what's going on. Help me understand what I'm seeing here because this image looks hilarious. This image looks scary. Tell me what you're thinking about these things.
It sounds like the solution is both simple and profound and difficult, and that is maintain communication, open communication with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, I love this, show up curious.
Yeah, yeah.
And ask them to show you what they're doing and try not to turn purple. When you're terrified.
Well, and I think there's a place here too for being sort of emotionally vulnerable with our kids to a certain degree, because if I'm terrified, being able to say, wow, this thing that I'm seeing right now is really concerning for me. And let me tell you why. I think there's some real power in that, and it invites our young people to be emotionally vulnerable with us.
Well, and to bring forth some of their own emotional maturity.
Absolutely.
As well. To me, that's about respecting them.
Yes, yes. And showing up with curiosity is really, it's a process of joining with mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. This is one of the things that I really encourage parents to do. I have, both of my kids are gamers. They game. Now, they have some, they're involved in a number of other things. Other than just gaming. And so gaming can be one of those places where kids get lost. Mm-hmm. They start to lose their social connections and so on and so forth. And that's when it can be a bit of a problem when they start checking out of other areas of life just to be involved in their digital.
Yeah, that's almost an addiction thing. That's another.
That's yeah.
Another
there again, a whole nother right? topic around digital addiction. But one of the things that I did early on is find some ways that I could be involved with them inside of their world as gamers so that one, we have a place where we can connect and two, I can sort of see what is this world that they create. Man, my younger stepson, actually both of them are into a genre of games called first person shooters,
mm-hmm.
which, As a parent, when I have my when I have my responsible adult hat on, I go, "Oh my gosh, look at all the stuff that's happening in front of me." And when I sort of can let go of that and channel my inner eighth grader or ninth grader, I'm like, this looks like a whole lot of fun. And in some cases, there have been some games where I'm actually playing head to head. So I'm getting some enjoyment out of it. Certainly not as much enjoyment as my teens are, because they beat up on me whenever I'm on the game because they're much better at it than I am. But it's a place where I can connect with them inside of something that they really enjoy. And I can ask questions about what's going on in this environment that I wouldn't be able to ask if I weren't a part of it with them.
We've been talking with mental health counselor Woody Pollack, who is here on Vashon Island. Do you have a private practice on Vashon?
I do, both West Seattle and here on Vashon. I have offices in both locations. Ah.
And you are the community training coordinator for VARSA, Vashon Alliance to Reduce Substance Abuse. We're running out of time. We've been talking about parenting teens in a digital age. And the positives are that there's a lot of information available, and the negatives are that there's a lot of information available.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Woody.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
I'm happy to be introducing a new feature to Real Talk today, and that is Mary Fran Lyons, who is an avid reader and is going to share with us some of her favorite books. So the new feature is called Lions on Literature, and I want to welcome you, Mary Fran. First book we're going to talk about is what?
It is a book called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and it's written by a slave named Harriet Jacobs. She actually lived before and then through and after the Civil War, so ultimately she was no longer a slave. But the book is one that is very well written, and I would say that the writing is quite sophisticated, to the point where when it first came out, and I don't know when the first publication was, but people refused to believe that it was written by someone who had been a slave. So I would say that that alone is pretty amazing. I probably read it first, I'm going to say about 30 years ago, and I've read it once or twice since then, and it's a book that you would want to read more than once. It's really an autobiographical account of her life as a very young woman. She was owned by a man who wanted to have physical relations with her, and she did not want to have physical relations with him. So much so that she went down the street and she had a physical relationship with another white man and had two children with him. So she really did not want to have a physical relationship with her owner. I will credit him with the fact that he did not rape her. But having said that, he really still was always trying to be with her. I mean, this is all in the book. So there came a point where she engineered a setup where it appeared as though she had run away. And that's all I'm going to say, because the rest of the story is pretty unbelievable. In my opinion, it would be a female version of 12 Years a Slave, sort of a story that is that compelling and just pretty amazing in terms of human resilience and fortitude and just getting through very rough times.
How was it this woman managed to be educated?
She was educated not as a young woman, I don't believe, although that's not the focus of the book, but she became educated through the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, she was part of teaching the children of freed slaves. One of the things I wondered about when I read it, not the first time, but as I read more about slavery, but I wondered, where did she have the personal fortitude to say, you know, I'm not going to succumb to what this man is trying to do to me? And that's a whole nother aspect that came out in a biography that I read about her. And the reason that she had so much self-esteem, you might say, to say, I'm going to take a stand here and do something about this, is because she was the daughter of it's kind of a complicated thing. In the South, when a little white girl would be born, they would give her a little black girl who was born about the same time, and they would grow up together, and then the black woman would be the white woman's slave. And when the white woman would have a child, guess who would nurse the child? It would be the black woman. At the expense of the black babies, of which there were many. Well, this young girl's mother was assigned to a white woman who was crippled. She never married, never had children, so she was never displaced from her mother's breast. So she got to grow up with a parent who cared about her and loved her. And so that was a very compelling aspect of her young life that I think really helped make her who she was in terms of, I'm going to do this, to her credit.
And that says so much about the impact of early childhood, of parenting, and how that affects individuals in their personal strength and self-esteem. Mary Fran Lyons, thank you so much. What is the name of this book again?
It is named Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and the author is Harriet Jacobs.
And the name of the slave girl?
Well, it's Harriet Jacobs. I mean, she's writing about herself.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. It's an autobiography.
So it's autobiographical and it's written in the first person.
Well, listeners, that is our first installment of Lyons on Literature with Mary Fran Lyons here on Real Talk. Thanks for listening.